This is Renegade Broadcasting. Everybody, happy Tuesday, actually. Yeah, I am doing a live show after all. The weather's just been really crappy. Freaking pouring out right now. No bike riding today. Summer is short enough as it is, and we're just getting crap weather lately. Anyway, got some very interesting news late last night before I went to bed. Vinny, who calls in frequently, sent me a very surprising, shocking email. Well, not so shocking, actually. Victor Thorne was found dead yesterday, ladies and gentlemen. Isn't that interesting? Very interesting. On a mountain near his home, he was found with a bullet wound. I think it was to his head, if I remember right. And, of course, they're trying to say it was a suicide. Yeah, whatever. That's two AFP writers in the past little over a year now that have turned up dead at a young age in their mid-50s. Michael Collins Piper last year, and now Victor Thorne at only 54 years old. Unbelievable. He had been focusing quite a bit on exposing Shillery Hillary, too. Quite a few of his books dealt with her specifically. Just find that very interesting. Wow. Anyway, I wonder what happened to his old partner in crime there. Almost my namesake, spelt a little different, but pronounced the same. Lisa Giuliani, was it? They used to do a show years ago. I think it was out of Pennsylvania or something. I wonder what ever happened to her. But anyway, wow. I didn't know him too well. I didn't know that much about him. But I don't remember now if I interviewed him as a guest. If I did, it was a long time ago on RBN or something. But I remember I did talk to him, more recently. I don't know, a few years ago. And I'll be damned if I can even remember what it was about now. It might have been about publishing a book or something. I can't remember now. It was years ago. But anyway, I've browsed through a couple of his books on occasion. It's just unbelievable, guys. Suicide my ass. Anyway, I wasn't sure exactly which topic I was going to cover first, as I mentioned yesterday, but I finally figured out this morning before my before the show started. We're going to look at some more fakery. We looked at the American Revolution in more detail. Saw all the fakery with that. Well, lo and behold, guys, the more you put things under the microscope, the more you see that, wow, that was fakery too. Oh, this was? Oh, and that too? It's not a question of what is fakery. It actually is a question of what isn't. And can anybody really name any major event that's occurred? Never mind in the past century, the past several millennia. Anyway, we got a caller on the line now. Welcome to the show, caller.
Hi, how you going, Charles? Sean from
Oh, hey,
Australia.
Sean, how's it going, man?
Yeah, good, man. The book you might have been looking for when it comes to Victor Thorne was 911 Evil, Israel's Central Role in the September 11, 2001 Terrorist Attack.
Ah, yeah, he's written quite a few over the years. I haven't been able to keep up with him.
It's no surprise to me that these people start turning up dead when they're writing books such as that.
He wrote another, I think it was him, a couple of years ago in the Holocaust. It was like a real short but very concise handbook, you know. So yeah, he's done a lot of good work.
I didn't know a hell of a lot about him. I've heard about him in the past. I think it might have been Peter Schenk that spoke about him at one stage, when I was sort of really just starting to get to understand Israel's hand in so many things. But it was actually what's his name? Oh, geez, the gentleman that does Incendiary Radio, Robert Rewalt. That does incendiary radio over there at RBN that sent me a picture just early my today with Victor Thorne's book cover. And I didn't realize why he sent that picture, but now that you've said that he was actually found with a bullet in his head, it makes all the sense in the world.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just yesterday.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep. All right, have a good show, mate. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks, buddy.
But
Wow, guys. Unbelievable, man. Last year, of course, it's almost 2 years ago now, but there was a stream of strange deaths that began just a little under 2 years ago. You had Oh, geez, what was his name? Oh, my mind's drawing a blank. I just rolled out of bed, so my brain hasn't kicked into gear yet. Oh, what the hell was his name now? Jesus, spoke out about Israel quite a few times. Former congressman from Ohio. What the hell is his name? Started with a K. Jesus Christ. I'm just not with it this morning. Anyway, I'm sure a lot of you know who I'm talking about. He died, and then, geez, I can't think of his name either. What the hell? Wow. From Idaho, he was an attorney. Oh, Jesus Christ, I can't think of his name either. He died in jail. I can't think of his name, goddamn. They pretty much set him up like they did with Randy Weaver. Son of a gun, my mind is drawing up. Oh, Victor Steele. Or Edgar Steele, or whatever the hell. Yeah, Edgar Steele. They killed him, but who's the senator, the congressman there? Jesus, man, I can't believe I can't think of his name. But anyway, it was those two. I think there was another one in between. And then later on, the following, what was it, June, I think it was, of last year, is when Michael Collins Piper, yeah, he did have heart trouble. So what? I mean, millions of people have heart trouble. To just turn up dead like that. And he was young, mid-50s. And now this story. Jesus, man, oh man, oh man. Well, that's one of the great kickback benefits of telling the truth. Anyway, to some extent, they really don't care if if you know the truth or even if you open your mouth, as long as you don't get too much attention. Apparently, he was getting too much attention. Written quite a few books. One of the reasons I really don't want that much attention. I mean, I want to get the word out, but I would prefer not to become a big name, big celebrity. I'm not on a death wish, and that's where it goes. That's where it goes. I don't want to become a big name too, because become big means a lot of people are gonna know about you, and I prefer most people don't even know this information anyway. They couldn't even freaking handle it. This information is only for a select few that are mature, that are open-minded, that actually, do their homework, that are able to handle reality. Anyway, but well, yeah, what a not shocking on the one hand, but still, what a that was quite a blow when I got that email. I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. Jesus Christ. Wow. Yeah, what a shame too. He cranked out quite a few books over the years. I'm sure he would have cranked out quite a few more as time went on, but no, unfortunately, not anymore. Kind of makes you want to get a job working for AFP. That's two major reporters that they've lost in the past just a little over a year. Very, very freaking strange. Anyway, let's get into our topic at hand here. As I was saying, guys, you start putting stuff under the microscope and you realize, my God, all the sacred cows start going to pasture, pun intended. You realize that there's nothing out there. You really do have to develop an open mind to be open to any possibility, because the lies are that extensive, that pervasive. I mentioned how, years ago I used to say, everything in this world is a lie, while yet being a Bible believer. And as I would say it, I assumed it was a given to my listening audience that I meant the Bible to be an exception. Why, you don't even question that. That's not a lie. Everything else is, though. Everything's a lie. Little did I know. Oh boy, little did I know that that not only wasn't an exception, it was one of the best examples of the lies that we've been sold. Holy horseshit. Major in your face, frickin' undeniable lie. All you have to do is have an open mind. That's really all you have to have. That's all that's required. You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to be a studious scholar. All you have to do is have an open mind, and you will see this world for the fraud that it is. The lies will fall onto your lap. It's people's inability to accept the reality of the situation that we're living in that prevents them from seeing what otherwise would jump up and bite them in the ass. The lies are right there, very obvious. Isn't it amazing? You talk about, hidden in plain sight. You can't miss the lies. They're so pervasive. They're everywhere. And they're not hard to expose. They're actually quite easy. You just, again, you got to have an open mind. Sometimes you do have to be a little studious. Sometimes you do have to dig, you know, not all of them are so easily exposed. Like this one we're going to be looking at today. This one isn't quite so easy. You do have to dig a little bit. But a great many of the lies, you know, that we've been uncovering over the years are actually quite obvious. I mean, you know, look at 9/11. Jeez. Right. Look at all these fake shootings. You don't have to dig deep for that. Jesus, it's in your face. They're getting sloppy because they realize, hey, we don't have to go that extra mile. In fact, I think they get off on leaving a trail of popcorn. You know, they are deliberately sloppy. Not only because they realize people are so goddamn dumbed down and so friggin' stupid they're not going to see it, but they know that there's a few studious ones out there that are going to catch them, but they don't care because they know that the whopping masses aren't even going to pay attention in spite of all the evidence. So they get off on that. Look at it. We can do this in plain sight. Leave all these clues. They get off on that. This particular scam we're going to be exposing, like I said, isn't quite so obvious. But once you start digging, it does become very obvious. Mr. Vladimir Lenin, ladies and gentlemen. We've been told that of all the plotters of the Bolshevik Revolution, he was one that wasn't a tribe member. Pretty much all the rest of them were, from Trotsky right on down, whose real name, of course, was Bronstein. But we were told that Lenin was an exception. He was a goy. No, sorry. He was no exception at all. He was every bit as much a tribe member, as we'll see, as was Mr. Trotsky. Absolutely no question about it. Until recently, I fell into that crowd of ignorance. I didn't think there was any point of looking into it. Enough of them were tribe members, you know, and everybody seemed to agree that he was. So I never looked into it. I just accepted it. Yeah. He was a non, I mean, everybody accepted that he wasn't a tribe member. So I accepted it too. I didn't think there was any reason to pursue it. What does it matter? All the rest of them were. He was just a sellout goy as far as I was concerned. No, guys. Tribe knows better than to have a major player like that in one of their most horrific schemes of all time, to let that work fall into the hands of an amateur goy. Oh, no, that required the hand of a professional tribesman who had corruption inbred into him, written in his DNA code. They wouldn't trust a high-level position in the hands of anyone else but a tribe member. And that's exactly what he was. As it turns out, the name Vladimir Lenin wasn't even his real birth name. Did you know that? Oh, should we be surprised? He simply made it up. His real name was Vladimir Ulyanov. And that is a tribe name, ladies and gentlemen. And so you might ask, why would the leader of the Communist Party or of the Soviet Union need to live under an alias? Does it make any sense for the leader of a country to have a fake name? Well, look at the leader of our country today. Mr. Barry Sotero. Well, here's your answer, guys. Because Mr. Vladimir Ulyanov was actually a tribe member, and aren't they so well known for doing just that, changing their names to hide their identity? He was indeed a tribe member. Perhaps not a full-blooded one, but then again, what does that mean? What's a full-blooded one? Is anybody full-blooded anything, really? But he does have tribal roots on both sides, mummy's and daddy's side, as we're going to see. Just like Mr. Trotsky, once again. Davidovich Bronstein. Anyway, Lenin's maternal grandfather, Alexander Dmitrievich Blank, was a wealthy tribal doctor who worked for the military. He was a tribe member. So, I mean, there's right there, there's tribal roots. His name was originally Srul Israel Moishevik, was his original name. He changed his name too. Lenin's maternal grandmother, Anna Groshkov, was either German and Swedish, or perhaps she was a German-Swedish Jew herself. But it looks like she had tribal roots as well on both sides. And by the way, isn't the name Blank rather suspicious as well? Blank. Was that not an attempt to hide his tribal roots? What's your last name? Oh, Blank. Anyway, let's get back to Anna Groshkov. She surely must have been a tribe member since she spoke Yiddish, ladies and gentlemen. And of course, since she married a tribe member herself, it's highly likely that she was also a tribe member. Anna's mother was Anna Osted, who also spoke Yiddish and was not actually Swedish. She was born in St. Petersburg to a family of goldsmiths who had emigrated from Uppsala, Sweden. Goldsmiths, who's known for having that kind of profession. Since most goldsmiths at the time were, in fact, tribe members, the odds are very high that these Olsteds were, in fact, Jews from Sweden and not Swedes. Oh, but there's more. If we check baptisms just before that time in Sweden for people named Olsted, we find marriages between the Olsteds and the Waldbergs. Waldberg, of course, I don't have to say, is another tribal name. And it just so happens that there was a rabbi at that time named Joel Waldberg in Lvov, Ukraine. There was also a Max Freer von Waldberg, Joel's grandson, who was Joseph Goebbels' teacher at Heidelberg in 1920, who recommended von Schultz as the subject of Goebbels' PhD thesis. Imagine that. Oh, guys, as I've gone along since I did my Hitler series, what was that, about a year ago, I guess? I've been finding a lot more problems with Mr. Adolf. In fact, I'm going to be following this set of notes up with an addendum to that Hitler series. Another interesting discussion regarding Hitler's early days that's very unsettling for the Hitler-worshipping crowd. I'm sorry, guys. There's no salvaging that little weaselly bastard. Mr. Adolf was not Germany's hero. You know, what I've already said on that should be enough to clinch the case, but what we're going to be looking at in the next set of notes we'll cover in the next, couple of days, is the final nail in the coffin with him. He was their little bitch, ladies and gentlemen. He was. He served them well. Anyway, as it turns out, there may have been a genetic link between Lenin and Karl Marx. For there was a Sophia Olsted who married a Samuel Mark in 1812 in Stockholm. Samuel Mark is not a Swedish name. While Samuel is certainly a tribal name, Mark is probably also a tribal surname and may have been connected with the name Marx, since this name was originally spelled as M-A-R-K-S instead of M-A-R-X. But even more intriguing, Karl Marx's paternal grandmother was named Luau, which is the same as Lvov when you transliterate it, the V and the W being interchangeable. Lvov, of course, is the Ukrainian town where the Waldbergs were from. And so the name Lvov was adopted from that town. Isn't that interesting? But it gets more intriguing still. Karl Marx had an uncle named Samuel Marx who lived at the same time as Samuel Mark. Were they one and the same person? Born in 1775, Marx's uncle would have been 37 in 1812. A good age to marry Sophia Olsted. Interestingly, this Samuel Marx was a member of Napoleon's Grand Sanhedrin, as well as Leon Marx. Oh, how interesting. Since there's no record of a Samuel Mark of Sweden in that period, he may indeed have been Samuel Marx. Here's another great point of interest. The Marx family was related to the Guggenheims, who later had the spelling of their name slightly changed to the correct spelling, G-U-G-G instead of G-O-U-G. The very Guggenheim family, of course. That were the creators of the Guggenheim Heritage Museums. Incidentally, there was also a Samuel Marx born in 1843, M-A-R-K-S, who was a South African billionaire who made his fortune in the exploitative diamond trade business. Samuel M-A-R-K-S, Samuel M-A-R-X. Surely he must have been related to Samuel M-A-R-X. This links the M-A-R-X or M-A-R-K-S family with the Oppenheimer and the Rhodes families. While it's been impossible to trace the exact lineage of Samuel M-A-R-K-S, we do know that he was supposed to have been a tribe member from Lithuania. Very interesting. All right, guys, short break. We'll look at some more very interesting tribal links to the planet.
This is the home. home for honest, uncensored, and hard-hitting live radio every night. Listen to a live show or visit the host's archives by clicking their pictures above. Sunday to Wednesday shows start at 8 p.m. Eastern, and Thursday to Saturday shows start at 10 p.m. Eastern. Join us at RenegadeBroadcasting.com.
Hey guys, welcome back. So, Mr. Samuel Marks, M-A-R-K-S, married Bertha Gutman, a tribe member. So that raises the ante even higher, doesn't it? That he was, in fact, a tribe member himself. Lenin's wife, Nadia Krupskaya, if I'm pronouncing that right, was also a tribe member. Oh, but he wasn't, though, was he? This guy has Jew written all over him, doesn't he? Her father, Lenin's wife's father, was a Krupski from Poland. And many people with this last name from Poland, if not all of them, were in fact tribe members. Nadia's mother, Tistrova, was clearly a tribe member as well. Her maiden name was Frolov, which is definitely a tribe name. Tistrova's grandmother had a great grandfather whose last name was Kozma, which is not a Russian name. It's Hungarian for Cosimo, as in Cosimo di Medici, for example. So once again, the Lenin tribal connections are absolutely legion. To say he's not a tribe member, to say he was a goy, come on. You've got to be kidding me. What's sloppy research? And I have to admit, my research was sloppy. By the way, this research isn't even my own. This is based on a paper written by, I'm sure a lot of you heard of him. If not, you need to check him out. He's pretty good. I don't agree with everything he says, but then again, you know, there's no two people that agree on everything anyway. But I mean, overall, he's got some great stuff. I've gotten actually several ideas from him, and I'm working on putting some notes together based on some other papers he's written as we speak. Miles Mathis, if you haven't checked him out, look him up. Miles, M-A-T-H-I-S. He's Jew-wise, by the way. And he's written other stuff, too, not just on politics. He's written a lot of things on alternative science, physics. Very interesting guy. But his research on this topic is the basis for this set of notes. I'll have to get him on sometime. He's, if you go on his site, he's got a lot of stuff there exposing all kinds of fiascos over the years. You know, that's his basic premise too, is that everything's a lie. All you got to do is look at it. Just start tearing it apart. Get your sniffer going and, you know, smell out the lies. They're there. You just got to sniff them out, Sometimes, again, most of the time, actually, they're very obvious. Sometimes, on occasion, they're not so obvious. You got to sniff a little more carefully. But everything is a lie. Anyway, we're told that Lenin's father, Ilya Nikolai Ulyanov, was born a serf, but later escaped poverty by studying physics and mathematics at the Kazan Imperial College. But how more ridiculous can you get than to tell an impossible story like this? Serfs were not admitted to the Kazan Imperial College, ladies and gentlemen, nor could they even afford to attend it anyway. And how could the alleged serf Ilya have managed to become so adept at physics and mathematics that he was able to pass the entrance exam? Serfs are kept busy. They don't have time to study physics and mathematics. Kazan was very exclusive, sort of like, the Harvard of its day. But even more exclusive, since it was a royal college. It's just ridiculous. Again, they just bargain on people being ignoramuses, not being aware of the facts surrounding cases like this, and not taking the time to look into them. But once you do undertake that effort, you realize, no way. It's like the Sandy Hooks and the Orlando shooting, and all this crap. You start putting it under close scrutiny, and the whole thing crumbles to dust. So it is with this. There's no way. His father was not a pauper, ladies and gentlemen. He was not a peasant. Wikipedia misdirects on this by calling it the Kazan State University on its Ilya page, but it was in fact a royal college. Lenin's father's father was said to have been a tailor, which would make sense if he was a tribe member, since that was almost exclusively a Jewish profession at the time. Lenin's grandfather was married to the wealthy Anna Smirnova. The Smirnovas are said to have been Turks, but Smirnova is not Turkish. It's Russian. Russian Jew. Quite possibly, they were Russian Jews, but we don't find any genealogy for Lenin's paternal side beyond his grandfather. So was this because the record was purged to hide just how tribally connected he actually was? Interestingly, Lenin himself claimed that he didn't know who his grandfather was. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure he didn't. Hitler went to great lengths to hide his heritage as well, as it turns out. But anyway, here was Lenin, the leader of a huge country, and his genealogy was scrubbed even while he was alive. No one knew anything about him. His own people had no idea who he was. Don't you find that just a little bit strange? We're told that Anna Smirnova's father was Alexei Smirnova, or Smirnov. In 1825, Alexei, we're told, her father, took possession of a freed serf named Alexandra Ulyanova. Now, that's quite strange, since 4 years earlier, Alexei's daughter, Anna, married Ilya Nikolai Ulyanov. Were Ulyanov and Ulyanova related? Probably not, because that would imply that the rich Alexei Smirnov had just allowed his daughter to marry a serf. Also strange is that we're never told who Anna's mother was. Who was Alexei Smirnov's wife? The most likely scenario is that the name Ulyanov was borrowed from this woman, Ulyanova, to cover the fact that Nikolai was a tribe member, taking on fake names. Alexei had already changed his name to Smirnov to hide the fact that he was a tribe member as well. And they most likely needed to do the same for Ilya. The source of Alexei's wealth has been lost, undoubtedly on purpose. What did he do to become so rich? We know that he was a starosta or village elder, but we know nothing of his occupation. Was he a bankster gangster? Anyway, it turns out that Anna Smirnova had a daughter named Maria, who married Nikolai Gorshkov, which of course is a tribal name. We find an Anton Gorshkov, for example, at the JewishWeek.com website. Definitely a tribal name. There's even a Dmitrio Gorshkov, who writes for the Times of Israel. Also, an Anton Gorshkov is listed as having been the fourth vice president of the Jewish Community Center of Bensonhurst. Was this the Anton Gorshkov? Anyway, if we go back to Lenin's father, Ilya, we find yet more strangeness. Wikipedia tells us that he became an active state counselor, equivalent to major general or rear admiral, in 1882, and he was awarded the Order of St. Vladimir Cross. In other words, he held a high position in the Russian military. He also wore the title of Dvoryanstvo, which means that he was a hereditary nobleman or member of the aristocracy. Hereditary? Can you say tribal royal bloodline? This means his children, such as Lenin, were also nobles. Lenin was an heir to the throne, ladies and gentlemen. He had royal blood. He was destined to be Russia's leader, just like all the royalty of Europe all through the Middle Ages, all with tribal blood. Some more than others, but nevertheless, they had it flowing in their veins. So much for Lenin having been born a serf, ladies and gentlemen, and so much for him having been a goy. Lenin's father's second wife was the daughter of a wealthy tribal military doctor from St. Petersburg, Dr. Israel Moishevich, who owned several houses in addition to the one in St. Petersburg. One of his homes in Kolkushkino was given to him by the Tsar, which gives us yet another link of Lenin to the aristocracy, very close to the Tsar. You know, when you start seeing these connections, you really got to start wondering. You really got to start wondering if the Russian Tsars were really genuinely opposed to the tribe, as we have been told. Were they also part of the royal bloodline? And was their seeming opposition more theater? Why should that surprise us? All the other nations all across Europe for countless centuries on end had tribal blood flowing in their veins. Why should Russia be an exception? Is it? We're going to look at some more troubling facts in that regard as we go along in this discussion. Anyway, we find that, like Lenin's father, Lenin's maternal grandfather, Alexander Blank, was granted hereditary nobility. Despite being a tribe member, he was a landed aristocrat. Not only was he not a serf, he actually owned many serfs himself. Some would insist that the Tsar must not have known that he was a tribe member, but he certainly did know. Blank actually sent a letter to the Tsar that was written in, can you guess, Yiddish. He sent him a letter written in Yiddish. So the Tsar must have spoken Yiddish himself, or at least he had a very close companion who could translate it for him. But why would he write it in Yiddish at all? And the fact that he did write it in Yiddish tells us that the Tsar must have known that he was a Yid himself and accepted that fact and still welcomed him into the fold, if you will. That's very troubling, isn't it? Are we to assume from this or maybe I should ask it this way. How can we assume from this that the Tsar was genuinely opposed to the tribe? Oh, the Russian people were. And so for window dressing purposes, this tribal-connected Tsar had to play the game. We've seen this so many times, haven't we, guys, all during the Dark Ages, where laws were passed by various kings on occasion. Many popes got in on the act, too, and passed laws, you know, that restricted tribal rights. And yet we discover that these kings themselves had tribal roots. The popes, very often, Christ Almighty, the Spanish Inquisition. The whole damn thing was created by tribe members. Alexander VI was a Borgia, ladies and gentlemen, a tribe member. And there he was, his top inquisitor, Torquemada, was a Sephardim. Ferdinand, who played a big role, of course, in the Spanish Inquisition. He had tribal blood in his veins, but his top advisor, Sant'Angelo, was a Marano. Unbelievable, man. So the whole Spanish Inquisition was fake opposition, wasn't it? Oh, they took out quite a few tribe members, but they didn't care. The important ones were secreted away and brought over to Jamaica to insist with their little piracy enterprise. Some were brought over to Amsterdam. Some were brought down to Morocco, where they had another piracy enterprise in operation, focusing on the Mediterranean, whereas the Jamaica operation focused on the Caribbean. Wow. So as we can see, we've got a long history of fake opposition against the tribe run by tribesmen. So now we come to the czars of Russia. Isn't it obvious what we're dealing with there? It was mere window dressing. The ones targeted were average, low-level, unimportant tribe members. The important ones were exempt. You know, we have to be cautious when we see someone from officialdom speaking against the tribe. We've seen that so many times, haven't we? We saw it, of course, with Mr. Churchill. That famous quote from the Sunday Morning Herald or Evening Herald, whatever the hell it was. Back in 1921 or whatever. Good quote. It's a true quote. But it was just rhetoric when he said it, wasn't it? The very tribe he was speaking against, he was their little bitch. So, we can't be too quick to say because someone made such and such a statement that, oh, that proves he was, you know, a truther. No. And as I pointed out, last year when I talked about Mr. Henry Ford, there's a very good example of that, guys. He was a fraud. Absolute fraud. No question about it. No doubt. A lot of good things were written, in his paper. Very truthful things. But he's got tribal fingerprints all over his ass. A tyrannical little bastard to his employees, had thugs watching over their shoulder constantly to make sure there was no talk of forming a union, or he'd have them pummeled in a back alley. He was perhaps the biggest supporter of the League of Nations, even more than Wilson. He paid for Wilson to go on a tour to push the League of Nations. He was a Mason extraordinaire, high-level Mason. So now we have to take a closer look at the Romanovs, don't we? Were they really opposed? Were the czars really opposed to them? Even though, they did take measures, they did pass laws, restricted, blah, 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 blah. But how many times have we seen that? That doesn't mean a goddamn thing, does it? We have to bring the czars into question, don't we? We got to bring everything into question. Anyway, in Robert Service's bio of Lenin, we're told that Alexander Blank's serfs, upon being freed in 1861, were left destitute. Blank did not allow them to renegotiate. This means that Blank stole huge tracts of land from his own serfs. Was he a classic elite pig or what? At any rate, we found that Lenin was an aristocrat on both sides of his family, that both his father and maternal grandfather were crypto-tribal nobles, and, not surprisingly, Lenin's native language was clearly not Russian. He was said to have accented in the wrong places when he spoke Russian. It wasn't his native language. The Encyclopedia of World Biography, for example, admits that Lenin had a speech defect when it came to speaking Russian. So what was his native language? Is it not clear that it was, in fact, Yiddish? This can be borne out by the fact that most of Lenin's original manuscripts don't even exist, and the ones that do were probably translated into Russian, but most likely weren't originally written in that language. How do you like that? Regarding Lenin's tribal connections, here's something else interesting to make note of. According to the tribe member Albert Lindemann in his 1997 book, Esau's Tears, Modern Anti-Semitism and the Rise of the Jews, he said, Lenin openly and repeatedly praised the role of Jews in the revolutionary movement. How do you like that? Openly praised their role. Who but a tribe member would do that? Lenin once said, an intelligent Russian is almost always a Jew or someone with Jewish blood in their veins. An intelligent Russian is almost always... Come on, guys. Tell me he wasn't a tribe member now. I mean, that should clinch the case right there. We're told that in May of 1890, Lenin's mother convinced authorities to allow him to take his final exams at a university of his choice, and that he chose the University of St. Petersburg and passed, obtaining a first-class degree with honors. Yeah, right. And he was raised a peasant. Oh, what a crock of shit. For starters, he had just turned 20 a week earlier. Secondly, he had been expelled after only one semester and exiled to house arrest. Thirdly, his brother had allegedly been hung as a revolutionary in 1887. So why would the authorities have been doing this family any favors? Fourthly, while under house arrest, Lenin wasn't studying for his exams. We're told that he was reading voraciously, but he was reading Marxist literature, not university frickin' coursework. This just doesn't add up. How could he have been doing both at the same time, and especially where he was supposed to have been a peasant? What a crock. His bio is mostly a blank until 1896, when he was charged with sedition. It's said that he was traveling in Western Europe prior to that time. Although we have seen that he was a noble, he was charged with planning to overthrow the Tsar. Really? For this, he was supposedly sentenced to 3 years in Siberia. But unlike others sentenced to Siberia, Lenin's trip looks more like a frickin' holiday, a vacation. His mother and sisters accompanied him, and he was assigned his own private house. Are you kidding me?
Oh, what a tough prison sentence he was
faced with. All right, guys. What craziness when we get back to this.
Buddy come from?
Well, little Jimmy, you see, the Jews print our money out of thin air and loan it back to us with interest, thus enslaving us through their usury.
Wow, I never knew Jews were so good with money.
Yes, little Jimmy, that's why the Jews have been kicked out of over 109 places in 79 different countries for doing the same exact thing.
Wow, they certainly know how to parasite.
They sure do. That's why I bank with Shekelstein Credit Union. Shekelstein Credit Union, printing money out of thin air and enslaving the goyim since 1913. Shekelstein Credit Union. They sure know how to parasite.
Since you've been gone, This is Renegade Broadcasting.
Guys, welcome back. Already in the second half of the show here. So Lenin, we're told, while serving his stringent prison sentence in Siberia, was able to correspond with known revolutionaries, and we're even told that they paid him visits. He was allowed to go on excursions to swim and hunt ducks while in Siberia. Really? A year later, we're told, Nadia joined him, married him, and lived with him, bringing her mother along with her. Oh, it was a big, happy little party, wasn't it? This stringent sentence of condemnation in Siberia. Does this really sound like a hardened criminal to you, ladies and gentlemen? What a sick joke. It turns out that Lenin was actually in Shushenkshoy, however you pronounce that. Although this is technically in Siberia, it is in the far south of that region, almost to Mongolia. St. Petersburg, by contrast, is actually much further north, being at latitude 60 compared to latitude 53 degrees where he was at. It gets so warm in the summer in this area, in fact, that people actually grow melons in the area. So what kind of a prison sentence was Lenin really given anyway? Was he really a prisoner at all? Or was he sent there to get his training for his future role as a great communist leader? The nobleman, Mr. Lenin. No surprise, after his sentence was over, he returned to civilization without having changed one iota, picking up right where he had left off. Soon he relocated to Munich in Bavaria, but then moved to London, we're told, 2 years later to avoid Bavarian police. But wait a minute. Why did Bavarian police leave this foreign agitator alone at all for 2 years? And why did they allow him to escape? Why did they allow him in the country to begin with? We might also ask why England let him in. Are we supposed to believe that he and Nadia swam ashore? How did they get through customs? He was a known, rabble-rouser, revolutionist. Are we also supposed to believe that they had no border patrol at that time? This sounds like the same manner in which Lee Harvey Oswald was able to magically return to the U.S. after supposedly having defected to the Soviet Union in the heart of the Cold War without any hassle or interrogation, wide open were the doors that welcomed him back after his so-called defection. Oh, this sounds so very familiar, doesn't it? After the Bloody Sunday Massacre of 1905, where Imperial troops allegedly fired on protesters, Lenin supposedly felt it was safe to return to Russia. But why? After all, he was still calling for the overthrow of the Tsar, was a known convict, and a known revolutionary throughout Europe. We're told that Lenin felt it was safe to return, more specifically, because the Tsar had made a few concessions in the October Manifesto. Yeah, right. What kind of concessions would allow for a known insurrectionist, treasonist, to come back into the country without any hassle? And an unrepentant revolutionary at that. None of this makes any sense, ladies and gentlemen. The history we are fed is meant for mental midgets that don't look into anything, that accept blindly what they're told. It makes no sense whatsoever. Anyway, we need to elaborate for a moment on the October Manifesto. We're told that Tsar Nicholas II was forced to sign this manifesto by Sergei Witt, who had written it. As it turns out, Witt was a first cousin of the famous Kabbalist Helena Blavatsky. Oh, what do you know about that? Little Miss Kabbalist. Not only was she a Kabbalist, but she strongly endorsed Maimonides, who she called the greatest Jewish sages. And she included the Seal of Solomon in the Amulets of Theosophy. How do you like that? Her real last name was Hahn, H-A-H-N, which is certainly not Russian. It's a common tribal name, of course, just like Jessica Hahn, as you might recall, a little tribal bitch there that set up Jim Baker, who, of course, was a scam artist anyway, but nevertheless, so was Bill Clinton, but he was set up too, wasn't he, by a tribal little bitch. Anyway, Witt, as it turns out, isn't a Russian name. So why was Sergei Witt the Tsar's top advisor and then prime minister? Witt's grandmother was a Kramer, another common tribal name. His great-grandmother was a Lady Zensky, yet another common tribal name. Oh, it just goes on and on and on. Anyway, no surprise, once back in Russia, we find that Lenin joined a radical newspaper in St. Petersburg run by Maria Andreeva, or Andreeva. Who was she? A very wealthy actress and professed Bolshevik. Oh, she had to be a tribe member. Her father was director of the Alexandrinsky Theater, and her mother was a prominent actress. Maria married Andrei Zelyabusky, a railroad tycoon. He ran the Kursk and the Nizhny Novgorod railroads. So we find another connection to industrialists here, and a most obviously tribal connection at that. The Alexandrinsky Theater was an imperial theater, meaning that it was built for the Tsar's troop. Zelyabusky, or Zelyaz, Oh, man, these names are hard to pronounce. Anyway, the railroad tycoon was also involved in the theater. So Maria Andreeva, a professed Bolshevik, was also tied to both the Tsar and the industrialists with these connections. So she was not only an actress in her professional life, but in her personal everyday life as well. She was an actress playing her little role. At one point, it looked like Maria was going to leave Zelyabunsky and move in with the famous Russian writer and socialist activist Maxim Gorky, whose real last name was Peshkov. Another man who changed his name. This is the Maxim Gorky, who said that the teachings of the ancient Jewish sage Hillel the Elder had deeply influenced his life. Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure those teachings did influence his life. Why is the question? What goy would make a comment like that? My. By the way, for his early writings, Gorky took the name Jehudiel, which means God of the Jews. That was his little pen name. Gorky was also connected with the Moscow Art Theater. He also had a very close relationship, apparently a gay one, with Vladimir Nemirovich Danchenko, director of the theater. So, was he a bisexual, or was he merely pretending to like Maria, who was also pretending to like him, apparently, just so they could pass on instructions to Lenin without drawing too much attention, perhaps? I mean, that's what's going on with the Clinton marriage. It's just a convenience marriage. You think they really give a frog's fat ass about each other? Shillery is a lesbo, ladies and gentlemen, and she's known from the word go that Billy Boy has been sleeping around with this, that, and the other, and she defends that because, again, it's a marriage contract based on mutual business interests. That's it. It's mutually advantageous for them to are you kidding? No wonder he was caught on film falling asleep during one of her talks last week. He could give a shit about her or her, him. They don't care. The only reason she ever got upset with him over the Lewinsky thing, they had a fight and a little brawl and she scratched his face and the Secret Service had to come in and break it up, and the makeup crew had to come in and touch up his face because he was giving a talk right after that. The only reason she did that is because he got caught. She was upset that it's going to ruin her political career. Anyway, Gorky is said to have later adopted a young Jewish man named Yeshua Sverdlov, who changed his name to Zinovy Ksov or Peshkov. Anyway. So he gave him a name, Pskov, very similar to Peshkov, which was Gorky's real last name. So isn't it obvious what was going on here? Gorky probably privately married this guy, but they made it out like it was an adoption for window dressing purposes. He adopted him like his adult son. Oh, give me a break. They were lovers, ladies and gentlemen. The two of them lived together in Capri. Zinovy, Gorky's lover, later joined the French army, was sent to the U.S. to agitate for our entry into World War One was decorated with the Legion d'Honneur, served in the foreign ministry in France, and ended up a brigadier general. But none of that is any cause for concern, right? There's nothing suspicious there. Look at how this guy effortlessly climbed up the ranks everywhere he went, in the U.S. and France. You got to be kidding me. Isn't it obvious he worked in intelligence? In 1906, Gorky was sent to the U.S. with Ivan Narodny to raise money for the Bolsheviks. They were welcomed in New York by the Lotos Club and its prominent members, including Mark Twain, William Dean Howells, and Robert Collier. Anyway, Ivan Narodny was another alias. His real name was Jan Sibul, which is naturally a tribal name. Anyway, later on, Gorky went back to Capri until 1913 with his little gay pal, Zinovie. We're told that they were in Capri to set up a school for Russian factory workers. Oh, really? In Capri? Capri is a resort island off the west coast of southern Italy, ladies and gentlemen. Wikipedia has this to say about Capri. Quote, prior to the First World War, and this is the time period we're looking at here, prior to the First World War, the island was extremely popular with wealthy gay men. So there you go. End of story. That's why Gorky and his little butt-banging bed buddy moved there to start a school for workers. Get the hell out of here. Gorky's most famous story was called 26 Men and a Girl. Yeah, that figures. As is typical of intelligence agents, Gorky was arrested multiple times, but he always managed to skate away with no trouble. We're told he was granted amnesty in 1913 as part of the 300th anniversary of the Romanov dynasty. But again, does this make any goddamn sense? We're supposed to believe that in order to celebrate the 300th anniversary of his family of czars, Nicholas II decided to invite unrepentant and noisy revolutionaries back to Russia. Cut the shit. Anyway, let's get back to Lenin. But boy, as you pick this thing apart, it's so full of holes, the whole damn thing, isn't it? In 1908, the Bolsheviks moved to Paris. But why would the French government open its doors to communist revolutionaries? Because they were well-connected insiders, that's why. And because it was known that they weren't really laboring on behalf of workers' rights, but were instead working counter to their interests. Oh, sure, we'll let you in. Gee, help set up the same thing here. We don't want workers' rights in our country any more than you do in yours. By the way, just prior to this time in 1912, Lenin had lived in Poland, where he frequented the Jagiellonian University Library in Krakow to do his research. The Jagiellonians were a tribal family with connections to the Medicis, ladies and gentlemen. Imagine that, going back to the Medicis. Anyway, at the start of World War One, we're told that Lenin was briefly arrested by the Austrians until his anti-Tsarist credentials were explained. So why was he later released? We're supposed to believe that Francis Joseph I of Austria, a king, was impressed by Lenin's stance against kings and thus let him go. And who do we know who's been against kings, by the way, overthrowing emperors and kings? Oh, come on now. But this raises the question about the Romanovs. If the Romanovs were in on the gag, why would they want their own thrones overthrown? Were they just role-playing? Were they going along with the gag because they realized the time had arrived? We, the royal bloodline, if we want to survive at all, we got to give in to the third faction, the Freemasonic secret societies and their banking interest. Was he convinced I might as well willingly go along with this? They'll protect me. I'll live a long life. I'll live a cozy, comfy, cushy life. It's inevitable. All the other kings and emperors of Europe have lost their power. It's inevitable anyway. Yeah, that's probably what was going on. That would be my guess. But anyway, let's skip ahead to the Bolshevik Revolution. Well, both revolutions, really. The 1905 and the 1917. Lenin's story, the story of the 1905 and 1917 Russian revolutions don't add up as to how they supposedly played out. I'm not saying they didn't happen. Of course they happened. And of course there was massive bloodshed. All of that happened. But how they came about, guys, they were staged like everything else. Although the protests in 1917 were confined to St. Petersburg and lasted less than a week, we're told that Nicholas II suddenly abdicated for no apparent reason. This 300-year-old dynasty went down without a whimper. Does this make any sense? Prince Gregory Lvov took over, but he wasn't even Russian. He was born in Dresden. He is said to have descended from Vikings who were not Russian. Oh, please. Although his wife's genealogy is partially listed, his own is not. Even his parents are not given, which is highly suspect. So what was Georgi Lvov's heritage, ladies and gentlemen? Can you guess? Recall how we discussed earlier that Karl Marx's paternal grandmother had the last name of Lvov, which is the same when transliterated as Lvov, and that it's a tribal name. So much for the claim that he was a Viking. Anyway, Prince Lvov soon turned the government over to Alexander Kerensky. Although Lvov was arrested by the Bolsheviks, he miraculously escaped and lived out his life in Paris.
Thank you for your cooperation. You're free to go now.
Meanwhile, as it turns out, Kerensky was a rich merchant from Moscow who was closely tied to Lenin. Kerensky's father had been Lenin's teacher, and the two families, again, were close friends. Unbelievable. So, it's very likely that the Kerenskys were tribal members as well. Holy crap, guys. Yeah. Can you believe how, once again, all you got to do is have an open mind and take a closer look. The whole official story crumbles to dust. This thing has smoke and guns all the hell over it. As it turns out, Kerensky's mother's name was Nadezhda. And the last name, even that first name sounds highly suspect. But guess what her last name was? Adler. Guess what kind of name that is? As well as being a tribe member, Kerensky, no surprise, was also a high-ranking Freemason. As fate would have it, tribal control in Russia went back to the first Russian Revolution in 1905. We are told that in that year, the real power behind the throne was Dmitry Trepov, head of the Moscow police. His paternal grandparents are scrubbed in the record, but his mother was a Lukich or Lukash, which is not Russian, ladies and gentlemen. His maternal great-grandfather was Moses Ivanenko, which is definitely tribal to the core. His wife was Molinyansky or Moila. That name is also tribal. Just a few years later, we find Alexander Krivoshein was said to be the most powerful man in Russia a few years after the first Russian Revolution. That name is also, you guessed it, tribal. So is it not obvious that both Russian revolutions, the 1905 and the 1917 revolutions, did not amount to an unsuccessful tribal coup? They were successful, not as successful as they hoped, but the tribe wound up running the country thereafter, didn't it? So they were much more able to stage the second one to finally accomplish what they wanted, having tribe members in key positions in the government. I would argue they were running it even before that through the Romanovs, through the czars and their royal bloodline. But not enough to their liking. If for no other reason, at least for window dressing purposes, many laws were passed to restrict what they could do in Russia. Now with the revolutions underway, all of that changed, especially with the 1917 revolution, instantly laws were passed to favor their interests. I mean, you'd have to be brain dead to not see who was pulling the strings here. Anyway, so, these revolutions were just staged for public show, guys. The aristocracy was actually in on the whole thing the whole time. They were calling the shots the whole damn time. How did Lenin and his buddies so freely travel in and out of the country? How did he get such a lenient sentence that he was basically having a vacation in southern Siberia, guys? All of this is only possible if the Romanovs were in on the gang. Of course they were. Short break, guys. Be right back. It's been a long time that we've been apart. Much too long for a man.
This is a public service announcement.
There is a serious problem facing our world today. People are actually believing what they see on TV and read in mainstream news. This has got to stop now. Jews own our media, and they are lying to us in order to achieve their objectives. The Holocaust, 9/11, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, the Charleston church shooting, and many more events were either Jewish false flags or hoaxes. Don't be a good goy. Get wise to the Jewish lies. Thank you.
Guys, so what do you think of this? It looks like the only reason why they staged a second revolution, why the first one wasn't adequate enough, is because the workers weren't happy with the October Manifesto. They felt that it didn't go far enough in liberating them from the oppression in the workplace, so they had to stage another one in which the masses would be ruthlessly either whipped into shape or outright slaughtered, which is just what happened, isn't it? With the Bolshevik Revolution. Under the guise of freeing the workers, oh, what freedom, all right. Freedom from their very lives if they didn't go along with the program. It was designed to whip them into shape, to accept their plight, and to oppress them even more. The whole thing was staged for public consumption. It was all tribal controlled from the top, not just the revolutions, but the very government, the very seat of government itself, ladies and gentlemen, the whole damn time. There was no genuine, real opposition on the part of the Romanovs. Sorry, I'm not buying it. But back to Lenin. After Nicholas II allegedly abdicated, Lenin needed to get back to Russia, but he was blocked, we're told. He decided to negotiate a passage through Germany. We're told the German officials, realizing that Lenin and his pals could cause trouble to their enemies in Russia, decided to allow 32 of these dissidents, including Lenin and his wife, to pass through by train. Why 32, though? That's a very suspicious number, isn't it? Was it because 33 was too obvious? Or was it because there are 32 Rhodes Scholars every year? There's always something going on with these numbers. But anyway, according to the official story, these dissidents weren't just anti-Tsar. They were anti-capital, anti-aristocrat, and anti-state, including the current German state. So why was Germany doing them any favors? Besides, the Tsar had already stepped down, so Lenin's anti-Tsar stance was a moot issue at this point, wasn't it? This story only makes sense knowing what we now know. These dissidents simply were not real dissidents. They were prominent actors that needed to get to Russia to play their parts, and a large part of their script was probably written from Germany, for all we know. We have a good indication of that from when Lenin arrived in Petrograd. We were told that the first thing he did was call for a continent-wide European proletariat revolution. You think Kaiser Wilhelm II in Germany wanted to see that? More to the point, do you think the German industrialists wanted to see that? No, what they wanted is what he proposed next, immediate peace with Germany. Not only did Germany achieve that, but within the year, they had achieved the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk, the payment of 6 billion marks out of the Russian treasury and the Baltic states. At this point, letting Lenin pass looked like a pretty good deal. After the July days in 1917, Lenin's arrest was ordered in Russia, but we're supposed to believe that they couldn't find him. Oh, man, this is so pathetic. This is like a Hollywood B-rated film script. We're told that all he had to do was hide in Razliv, a small town near St. Petersburg. But that's absolute hogwash, ladies and gentlemen. He would have stuck out like a sore thumb there. He wouldn't have lasted 24 hours in such a place. He then moved, we're further told, to safe houses in Helsinki. Again, he wouldn't have lasted 10 minutes there either. The Finns would have spotted him and would have handed him over immediately to Russian police. This whole story, the whole damn thing reeks. Anyway, the next phase of the absurd story is the tale of the October Revolution, of course, the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution. Let's look at that. We're told that General Kornilov attempted a coup and that our little tribal friend Kerensky asked the Bolsheviks for help to fight him off. The coup actually never materialized, and that's admitted, but they use this to explain how the Bolsheviks returned to open political arena. Mainstream historian Richard Pipes admitted that this Kornilov episode was manufactured by Kerensky, but of course he fails to read it correctly. The correct reading is that this whole history was managed and the Bolsheviks were installed as part of the great script. All fakery, ladies and gentlemen, how this whole thing came about. Without recognizing this fact, nothing that we have been told about this time makes any sense. We've been told that various Soviets elected Bolsheviks, including Trotsky, but that's all a ruse, ladies and gentlemen. These Soviets weren't composed of real workers. They were composed of planted agents who then simply installed these Bolshevik actors. Just like our elections, all fakery, all designed for public consumption, for the dumbass masses to think that they have some power. It's so fake that even though the candidates are handpicked so that it doesn't matter which the hell candidate you vote for, their agenda is going to march forward and you're going to continue to get screwed, they still rig them so that their most favored candidate still winds up being El Presidente, regardless what box you check off. Holy Jesus Christ, what a frickin' mess. It just blows my mind how so many Americans can read about other countries in other ages or even current ages, you know, third world countries. They have no problem seeing that other governments screw over their people, lie to them, stage fake events. No problem at all. But the minute you mention that happening here, the country that does it more than any other on the goddamn planet.
Oh, no, are you kidding? We are a crazy conspiracy theorist.
Oh, so let me get this straight. You admit that other governments throughout all of history have done this shit, but ours is an exception. Oh, I get it. Okay. You ever hear that saying, absolute power corrupts absolutely? Who has absolute power today? Dumbasses out there who like to worship their frickin' government. Anyway, we're told that the workers had soured on the Mensheviks and social revolutionaries for their support of the provincial government. But since the Mensheviks and social revolutionaries were alleged to have been just as responsible for thwarting the coup, confronting the army, it's never explained why the Bolsheviks were heroes and the Mensheviks were goats. The Bolsheviks then planned the big insurrection for October, making no effort to conceal it from the standing government. They weren't, you know, walking on eggshells, covering their tracks. Notice how your eyes are always off of this standing government, though. We're supposed to assume that they're just sitting there with their hands tied. This was going on right in front of them, but they couldn't do anything about it. The local police and standing army have just evaporated, and Russia is apparently being ruled by ghosts. Why was nothing being done? Wikipedia admits that President Kerensky was aware of the Bolsheviks' plans, but he did nothing about them. Something's very wrong with this picture, ladies and gentlemen. Very wrong indeed. He ordered no arrests and didn't mobilize the army. It was a total stand down to ensure that the revolution was successful. He was in on it, of course. He was a tribe member. How can we expect otherwise? The Bolsheviks took Russia with no battles. The standing government offered no resistance whatsoever. Among other ridiculous things, we're told that the provisional government was unable to locate any serviceable vehicles. Yeah, right. Also, notice the name provisional government. That puts in your head the idea that this standing government was just temporary, waiting for the Bolsheviks to arrive and supplant it. Oh, what an interesting name. How revealing that is. Like there was an anticipation of another government arising soon to take its place. But you really think the standing government called themselves that? What government would call themselves provisional? None of this looks real. An existing structure doesn't just dissolve down to nothing, especially not without a fight, ladies and gentlemen. The army and police don't just switch sides en masse with no split, with no contention. We have to ask not only what happened to the Imperial Army, the old police, the old intel, and the old guard. We also have to ask what happened to all the factionalism that we were sold in the years before. What happened to the Mensheviks and social revolutionaries and all the other fake factions that acted as foils, you know, to the Bolsheviks before October of 1917. Where were they now? What happened to all that rhetoric of resistance? They apparently just laid down and let the Bolsheviks take Russia. That was their job, wasn't it? Just like, you know, with all these fake shootings, where are the police? How does this shit go on for hours on end? We saw it with Virginia Tech. We saw it with Orlando, you know, the Batman shooting. My God, all of them. for hours. The same with this horse shit here. No wonder we see a repeating pattern. It's the same goddamn people plotting these bullshit things. They don't care that the story is ridiculous. Like I said, I think they go out of the way to make it ridiculous. They get off on it more that they can fool people so easily. Amazingly, some mainstream sources now admit that something smells fishy with this whole story. Wikipedia, for example, has this to say. Later official accounts of the revolution from the Soviet Union would depict the events in October as being far more dramatic than they actually had been. This was helped by the historical reenactment entitled The Storming of the Winter Palace, which was staged in 1920. This reenactment, watched by 100,000 spectators, provided the model for official films made much later, which showed a huge storming of the Winter Palace and fierce fighting. In reality, however, it says, the Bolshevik insurgents faced little opposition. The insurrection was timed and organized to hand state power to the Second All-Russian Congress of Soviets of Workers' and Soldiers' Deputies, which began on the 25th of October. After a single day of revolution, 18 people had been arrested and 2 killed. 18 people arrested and 2 killed? Did you catch that? This was supposed to be one of the biggest revolutions in history, and yet we find that perhaps only 2 people were killed? Holy shit! This is jaw-droppingly ridiculous! After a single day of revolution, says Wikipedia, 18 people had been arrested and 2 killed. It's jaw-dropping. Did you know that, you know, the casualties were that minimal in what was supposed to have been a major revolution? Why, they overthrew the government. Where was the fighting, the resistance? Where's the bloodshed? There should have been tens, hundreds of thousands of people. Well, there were later, weren't there? Oh, they killed millions later. But at the time of the revolution itself, 2 people killed? More people died in St. Petersburg that day from natural causes than this frickin' so-called major revolution, overthrowing of the government. More people died that day in St. Petersburg from frickin' rabies or choking on a bone than what died from this revolution. All staged, ladies and gentlemen. All staged. Like so many other events in history, this whole thing was just a smoke and mirrors show. So we must assume that the Bolsheviks were simply installed with nothing but some fancy fireworks to cover the installation. But who installed them? European tribal capitalists, of course, who funded the whole damn thing. We have seen many of their fellow tribal agents earlier in this discussion. There's no question. The tribal connections are legion. So naturally, not only were they behind the Bolshevik Revolution, but to the point where it really wasn't a revolution at all. Well, I mean, it was revolutionary, but it wasn't a violent overthrow. There was no violence. I bet the 2 that were claimed to have been killed probably weren't even killed either. It was just all staged. Maybe they had, you know, some fake blood, like with so many other similar events. Unbelievable, man. And as I said, we're going to follow this up with another Hitler discussion. Oh, my God, the fakery that went on there, guys, right from the word go. Fake, 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 fake to the core. When you look at that kind of startup, how can you expect that he would be anything else but fake later on when he arose through fakery? We'll be delving into that tomorrow. Anyway, let's finish up these notes. Although we're told the entire city went to the Bolsheviks in a matter of hours, Kerensky somehow escaped, as I said, while the Winter Palace was reportedly surrounded by everyone in Russia. We're supposed to believe that Kerensky magically got away without the Bolsheviks catching him. He somehow escaped to Paris and lived there until 1940, and then later ended up in the United States. He became a fellow at the Hoover Institute at Stanford, which, of course, is a major spook hangout. Oh, my God. But what about the alleged deaths of the Romanovs? With all we have been discovering, we must conclude that the deaths of the Romanovs were faked like everything else. Just think about it. Although everyone else was able to escape from Russia easily, how is it that the Romanovs weren't able to do so? Obviously, the script demanded that they be killed to completely demoralize the Russian people so that they would give up hope of ever being able to restore their former system of government. Here are some important points to make note of regarding the alleged deaths of the Romanovs. Number one, the head executioner was said to be Yakov Yurovsky, who was admitted as having been a tribe member. His mother was named Esther Moisivna, which means her father was named Moses. Translated, that's what that means. Yakov was not a soldier, folks. He was a watchmaker. He's said to have been part of Lenin's secret police. But since they were secret, we have no possible confirmation of that now, do we? So clearly, he was just another actor in this phony drama. Number two, Nicholas's skull wasn't found until 1991, and it had no bullet holes in it. The bodies, number three, were supposedly discovered in 1979 by amateur archaeologist Alexander Avdanin, but there's no information on him. The remains were allegedly identified in 1998 by Russian, British, and American scientists. But do you suppose we should trust these sources? You know, I remember back in the, I think it was the early 90s, they exhumed the body of President Zachary Taylor. They examined it, you know, did a forensic study to supposedly to silence the conspiracy-minded crowd that he was murdered. It was claimed that he had been poisoned, but they examined his hair and his nails, and they said there was no trace of cyanide poisoning or arsenic or whatever. Well, actually, they lied because Michael Parenti got a hold of the coroner's report, or the, you know, forensic report. And sure enough, the levels detected were very high in arsenic or cyanide, whichever it was. He was poisoned. God damn it. So, you know, they lie about these tests all the time. Interesting, isn't it? That as DNA testing has gotten more accurate, all that means is they can more easily get away with lies now. Yes, they can more accurately do DNA tests. But because of that accuracy, that gives them a greater propensity to lie and say. It's unfortunate, but, you know, your average jury member doesn't know a goddamn thing about DNA testing. And so, you know, it's easy to just simply say, it still comes down to taking the doctor's word, doesn't it? Well, when a doctor is handed a big fat check, or he's part of the cover-up team to begin with, or he has the threat of his life or maybe his loved one's lives hanging in the balance as to whether or not he goes along with the scheme, you can see the potential is very high to lie with DNA tests. And that is unfortunately all too often the case. So we can trust them to say that these bodies were positively identified. How do we know? The answer is we don't know. So the whole murder of the Romanov family story is probably bullshit, like everything else in the story we've been looking at. Number four, as it turns out, prosecutors opened an investigation into the Romanov deaths in 2007. Now, that was real timely, wasn't it? Why did they open up an investigation in frickin' 2007, almost 100 years later? Are you shitting me? In fact, 90 years later. Yeah. They decided then. The remains were found underneath a dirt road in Yekaterinburg, which means that the conspirators hid the bodies. But that makes no sense, does it? Wouldn't a public execution have been more to the point and bury those remains openly with pride, with a big memorial? Here lies the bones of the murdered Romanovs, a very proud day in Russian history, blah, 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 blah. Why did they hide them? You only need to hide the bodies to prevent any forensic work, ladies and gentlemen, from being done on them, which would show the bodies to not be those of the Romanovs. End of story. Anyway, we're not quite done with the notes. It's a couple of arrogant and hidden information. All right, guys, have a great day. See you then. Take care.
Are the top five reasons not to vaccinate. 1. Vaccines have never been proven safe or effective. Vaccine studies funded by pharmaceutical companies compare vaccine side effects from one vaccine to another. 2. Vaccines do not work. They may create a temporary increase in antibodies for a particular disease, but this does not equate to immunity to disease. 3. The very first vaccine was a disaster. Vaccine safety and effectiveness is a created myth, strongly embedded in the American psyche. 4. Vaccines are highly profitable for pharmaceutical companies in the healthcare industry. 5. Every study comparing unvaccinated to vaccinated children demonstrates that unvaccinated children enjoy far superior health.
What's your name?
Billy.
I like that name. Have you been a good little boy?
Yes. Yes.
How old are you, Billy?
I'm 26. I'm an entertainment lawyer in Beverly Hills.